Hello, and you are listening to the Fanboy Strike Back Weekly Review Podcast, episode 17.
I'm Eric.
I'm David.
And we are the Fanboys Who Strike Back. Every week we come here, we read comics, and we like to discuss what we thought of this week's comics. And also we have a couple other features. This week we will be doing a special Halloween presentation of The Monster Squad. A very good movie for those of you who are not initiated, and a treat for those of you who are. So get ready for that. And also we have a question that comes from us from a viewer or a listener. Of our top five list of costumes, comic book costumes, past, present, or future. So we will be getting to that a little bit later. Just a warning, we do like to talk about everything that happens in the books, so if you didn't read your books, you probably want to pause the podcast and come back to it after you've read your books so you aren't spoiled. With that said, David had the book of the week this week, so what'd you pick?
I went with X-Men number 204.
So I'm gonna go get a drink or something.
Hey, you're actually gonna like this. This is good. This is good stuff, even to a non X-Men fan. I actually picked the book like last month, and I've talked about it a little bit over the past couple months because I have not been a huge fan of Mike Carey's run on the X-Men. I thought his first two arcs pretty much made, like, no sense. I had no idea what was going on. And I've been trying to explain on the podcast what's been going on in this book, but I've had no idea. Because they've been hunting down certain mutants, like Cable and Blindfold, and it looked like Sinister, who was back with the Marauders, was trying to hunt down mutants that have anything to do with the future. And basically what issue 204 is that this is leading in straight to Messiah Complex, which starts next week, but we have finally, it was almost like everything came together. And while I was not a big fan of Mike Carey's first arc, after reading this issue and reading how things have come together, it makes me go back and appreciate what was happening in that arc more. Because what we do finally figure out is that the Messiah Complex storyline, which, you know, I've been really excited about, it's the first big X-Men storyline in almost 10 years, is it's the first new mutant born since Decimation. And the whole idea is that, is this mutant going to be a savior of the mutant race? Is it going to destroy the mutant race? And who is going to get to this mutant first? And you find out that that's what Sinister has been doing this whole time. He's been basically taking out any mutants that have knowledge of the future that are related to the X-Men, because Sinister knows what's about to happen, and he's trying to get.
So was that why Cable was attacked a couple issues back?
Yes. Any mutant that had any kind of knowledge of the future, of any kind of alternate reality, Blindfold is she's a new X-Man who can see the future. Sinister was systematically trying to take every single tie that the X-Men have to knowing the future away from them, and it's worked, because at this point, none of the X-Men know that this new mutant is about to be born. Which we know already in Messiah Complex that Sinister gets to this new mutant first. And the X-Men are trying to kind of, you know, play tag along. So, it's a really weird feeling to, like, honestly, like, I have not been a fan of Mike Carey's arc at all. Like, I thought his first, you know, couple of stories were just horrible. But after reading this issue and, like, trying to figure out what's been going on, I was like, yeah, he did an awesome job. Like, kudos to Mike Carey. He did a great job. So, obviously this is not a jumping on point, issue number 204. But I do believe that while Messiah Complex is going to be very involved in X-Men lore and that it's going to be in every single X-Men book, I do believe Messiah Complex is going to be as good as a jumping on point on that you can get when it comes to X-Men. I mean, when I first started reading X-Men, it was in the Executioner storyline, which was probably back in, like, 91 or so. And that was a big crossover storyline and everything. So there's no easy way to get into X-Men. But, like, I am so excited about Messiah Complex. So go buy it.
I'm going to shill him for Marvel now.
Hey,
so
I can't help it.
Yeah, I'm somewhat disappointed and impressed by myself. I knew some trivia. I could throw something at you there.
And you know you're excited about Messiah Complex. Don't try to hide it.
You know, I want to be, but the more I'm
you are.
But it's going to be so many books to buy now. I'm like, ugh.
And so, one last thing is that we finished up the Endangered Species storyline in this story. I hate to admit it, but nothing really happened through the whole storyline. I understand that it was, like, kind of building up into Messiah Complex and the whole, the background of it, but basically what we got in this last, episode or issue of Messiah, or of the Endangered Species, is that Beast actually tracks down Wanda Maximoff, the Scarlet Witch, and has a conversation with her. And yes, Wanda's crazy. Wanda's always been crazy, and she's still crazy. And she's basically trying to play off the fact that she doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know that she's a mutant, and she doesn't know the things that she's done. But there's that overall shadow that she does really know what's going on. Like, there's a part of her that does know exactly what she's doing. And so Hank is trying to talk to her. And he's trying to ease her into these things. Like, he's trying to ask her these little questions to get this big answer. And at the end, she kind of just says, you know, this probably isn't a good idea. She's like, you know, the questions that you're asking, she's like, I don't know what they really mean, but they don't sound like questions that you should be really chasing. And Hank kind of looks at her, and he kind of just lets it go. So
wait. You had, like, how many issues of backup story to just let it go?
Like, yeah, it was pretty anticlimactic. I mean, I was pretty happy with Endangered Species as an overall story because, honestly, I wasn't expecting anything out of it. But I can really understand how people are pretty disappointed in, because nothing really happened. Honestly, like,
well, yeah, I mean, it seems happened. Like. Just kind of out of character, like, apparently, like, he thought it was a big enough deal to contact all the villains, or all the X-Men villains, at least, and, you know, kind of sell himself and sell his soul and all that kind of stuff. And at the end, he's like, she's like, oh, don't look at that, you know, forget that.
Well,
understand. That's stupid. That's horrible.
Well, no, because there's more going on, because when you're dealing with Wanda, everything kind of changes. Because Beast is kind of looking at her like, she's kind of like a ticking time bomb. And it's someone that you don't want to make upset, and more importantly, like, you don't want her to go over the edge. And so I think he tried all these different avenues, he tried, like, science, and he tried magic, and finally he got to the source. And I think he's not giving up on the mutant race and, like, finding a cure, as you might say, but he's giving up on the fact that, like, you can't try to get anything out of Wanda Maximoff. So
I don't know. It seems like
it's a little confusing.
No. I kind of get what you're going for. It's just, it seems like if he's going to take those drastic steps, and I'm talking out of my ass at this point because I don't know.
I think you have good points.
But if he's going to go through all these steps, and if he says, okay, I've tried all these other avenues, I'm going to go after Wanda Maximoff, who's responsible for the whole M-Day thing, that right. He's going to have a contingency plan in case something, you know, in case she did kind of start going over the edge or something. He's not just going to, like, turn and run at the first sign of trouble. Like, to me, that seems insulting to every reader who's been picking up that storyline. It's like, you just shelled out how much money and screw you guys.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's why, I guess, like, I don't feel bad because it was a backup story. And so if I would have paid for these, I would feel different. And I wonder if that was the whole plan, because obviously they've never really done anything like this before. So maybe they're like, well, I don't know. Maybe it was just a tool to try to hype up Messiah Complex. That could truly be it, too.
Yeah.
So,
well, I'll let it go. But yeah, if I was a Marvel boy, if I was a Marvel zombie, I'd be pissed.
Okay, Eric. So, what would you have picked as the book of the week this week?
Well, I know we tend to center, or at least I tend to center a lot around the green titles of DC. Right. But I'm on an Oliver Queen high right now. Like, I can seriously not get enough of the guy.
I'm really afraid that you're going to be talking about Green Arrow Year One number 6 because my story ran out of this, and so I could not get the last issue.
I am going to talk about it, and it's so good.
Oh, crap.
It's so good. Like, I cannot wait for this to come out in trade, like, just to have on my bookshelf. I was so
disappointed when they were out. I couldn't believe it.
Well, it's weird because it was supposed to come out, like, every 2 weeks, and then this last issue got pushed back pretty far. But Andy Diggle, who writes this, like, I can't remember ever reading anything from him before, but damn, he's good. He's really good. And I mean, the Oliver Queen origin story was always kind of hokey. Like, he fell off a boat, you know, and then he had to learn. He washed up on Desert Island. He had to learn how to survive. This really kind of gives him more of, like, why he became a hero instead of just going back to a life of complacency after he got back. But Jock's art in this book, like, there's really nothing bad about this book, and I know we've talked about it before, so I'm not going to beat it into the ground, but it served as a very nice, well, it was a very nice intro to his current career, and especially with all the exposure that he got as being the mayor of Star City 52, his new series with Black Canary, which is great. We, you know, of course, we all knew Oliver Queen wasn't dead again, so we found out what happened there. Also, he's been getting a lot of exposure in the Justice League Unlimited cartoon, which I've been watching. He's been in The Batman recently. I've been watching a lot of Smallville Season 6, and he's awesome in that show.
Yeah, he's great in that show.
And so, and then just to have this cap off on top of it, I was just like, by the time I was done with it, it's just like, that was just perfect comic booking.
You've been in a Green Arrow fix.
I am. Like, I'm just loving it right now. So that would have definitely been my pick. It was very, very good. I'd love to see both Diggle and Jock. These are names now that I'm like, when they come out with the next project, I'm going to be looking for it because
I definitely agree.
They really impressed me with this book.
Yeah, they really jumped on the spot with this book. I think this was I think DC thought that this was going to be a big hit, but I think across the board, this was a much bigger hit than they expected it to be.
Right, and I don't know, like, I haven't really been hearing a lot of people talk about it, which is kind of weird. I know it's selling really well, and it's been getting really good critical praise, but I just haven't heard many people talk about it. So I hope people have the same consensus that we do, because I'd like to see more Oliver Queen projects. I'd like to see these guys get more work. So, well done. So,
you did not pick up Green Lantern Corps this week. Did you?
I did. I'm on that book now.
Okay, because I was very interested to know what you're going to think about what happened in this issue, because I had mixed feelings.
So do I, actually.
Okay. So, yeah, tell me what you thought about this.
Okay, I'm going to go with pros and cons. Pros, I thought this was a very cool issue to see just all the Green Lanterns coming together. We've talked about it before, but this is more than a military book. Like, this...
Right.
You see the Corps acting as the Corps has always, should have always been portrayed, and which is really odd, because I've been reading Green Lantern books for a very long time, and usually it's just a bunch of, like, guys, like, yeah, let's go get them, and then just jocking it, or, you know, duking it out, but this seems like they're organized, they're trained, it seems like an organization, a force, right. And so that's one thing I really like about this book. Now, some developments that occurred in this book, we're going to spoil it. So, basically, the big rookie on the team who's been kind of the star of this book lately, he's got kind of a Kryptonian heritage.
Right.
So, in this story, the Sinestro War is on Earth now, and the Corps has come to Earth as backup. And so, of course, this guy gets on Earth, and he gets Yellow Sun. So, basically, he becomes Superman with a Green Lantern ring. Which, exactly. You know, I already have a problem with all the Kryptonians that they're throwing around in the Superman universe right now. I've always had a problem with Kara. Like, one of the defining elements about Superman is he's alone, and he's so much more of an interesting character when he's alone. He is the last Kryptonian. That is, and it seems like every 20 years people just forget that, and they're like, ah, I'll give him a, you know, do this, do that, you know, give him some family. And then, like, he loses so much more luster. It's like, yeah, I don't want to see Superman as the family man. Like, we've seen that with Connor, and he wasn't even a father to Connor. So it's like, just give up on that. Like, I don't want it. And so, first of all, I got that here, and of course, the guy's eyes started glowing red, and I was like, ah, hell. And then the Guardians have rewritten the Book of Oa. The Anti-Monitor is loose on the planet, so, of course, Ion has been freed at this point. Not Kyle Rayner's Ion. I'm not getting this in a second.
Yeah.
But the glowing fish Ion, who is the kind of spirit of the Green Lanterns, as Parallax is the spirit of the Corbians, whatever. So they think they need a new torchbearer because Kyle has been infected by Parallax now, and he is no longer capable of carrying that burden on his shoulders. First of all, screw the Guardians, all right? I am so sick of Kyle.
I knew that this was going to be a point where you were going to get a little bit upset.
Oh, I was pissed at that. And then they took this rookie and they bestowed the power of Ion on the rookie, so he is the new Ion at this point. Now, okay, that's all good and fine if Ion had been a character that the Guardians had created or anything like that, but the whole problem with the big floating fish Ion thing is that the Guardians have never had Ion in the past. Kyle Rayner created Ion when he got all the power. And
Ion is very Ion is a retcon. Ion is a retcon by Geoff Johns saying that what Parallax was an entity, and so Ion has been there the whole time.
I understand that. But
no one knew about it.
He made Parallax work as a retcon. Like, you're not screwing up past continuity, really, by saying that's what happened. This, you're kind of messing with it, because that was a Kyle Rayner creation. Unless they're saying that when Kyle, you know, restarted all the Guardians' lives again, that he also put that thing in there, too. So, there's that. Also, there's no, like, the dude's a rookie. Come on, he's good for a rookie. But dude, come on! Don't give him like the most ultimate power in the universe. Like this is so like Hell Jordan Parallax waiting to happen.
Well, so. I mean, and you know, we can wait and see. I was very confused because you see, I still don't know his first name. It's like Saddam or something, but his last name's Yat, so I just call him Yat. You see him go against the Anti-Monitor, and the Anti-Monitor basically just keeps on trying to kill him. And he's not going down. And that's the point where you see that his eyes are glowing red. And so you do see that he is a Kryptonian in some way. Which we kind of talked about in the last podcast. Because it said he made an off comment about how he was raised under Krypton's red sun. But he wasn't from Krypton exactly.
It was like a sister planet or something like that. Yeah,
sister planet or something. So obviously they're going to have to kind of reveal this. I have really mixed feelings about it because this kid's a Kryptonian doesn't mean that he should be as important as he is. And they didn't say that. You know, they said that it's because they of his bravery and courage. But yeah, like Eric, you and I are both Kyle Rayner fans. If I see Ion, I think Kyle Rayner. I see Green Lantern. I think of a lot of things. I think of Hal Jordan, John Stewart, Kyle Rayner, Guy Gardner, but I see Ion, I think of Kyle Rayner. That was something that was given to him to set him apart after the Corps came back, after Hal Jordan came back.
Yeah,
and so
the fact that he was the torchbearer, like, he kept the flame alive the whole time on his own. Like, that's why he was the torchbearer, and that's why he was Ion.
I think that a lot of Kyle Rayner fans have had a fear of what was going to happen to him with Hal Jordan coming back. And I think we felt a little bit better when we found out that he was going to be Ion again. But we felt a little bit worse when we found out that he was going to be part of the Challengers. And now I feel pretty bad knowing that he's just going to be a regular Green Lantern and part of the Challengers of the multiverse. because it seems like that's an easy way for Kyle Rayner to become a forgettable character.
Yeah. And is it bad now that, like, I don't wish for good things to happen to him anymore. I just hope that he stays alive. Like, and that's like, you know, skimming the bottom of the barrel is, oh, just make it through. Come on, just help us. Okay. Yeah. Like, it's, and that's so not a good sign, so.
I don't think things are looking, I don't think he's in danger. And it's kind of like what I said before, like, I was kind of excited when I heard that they were going to put Don, Troy, Jason Todd, and Kyle all together, because those are characters that they just don't know what to do with. But now I have the total opposite effect, because I feel like they're characters they don't know what to do with, so they're just throwing them all together, and then they're just going to be forgettable as a group instead of alone. You know what I mean?
They still don't know what to do with them. Yeah, that's the problem. So, yeah. All right. On to the next one.
What do you got next?
I got The Flash number 233. Because this is another book I'm very, very conflicted about.
Yeah.
I'm a very big fan of Mark Waid. I'm going to just say, you know, I love Kingdom Come. I got my big Absolute Edition signed by him, and it was a big highlight for me, and I loved his old run on The Flash. It was fantastic. It was my favorite run on The Flash was the Mark Waid stuff, and then Geoff Johns was second, but Mark Waid was
second. I agree.
This book has just not been that good, you can be the best writer in the world, you're going to have an off story, especially if you haven't written a character for 15 years or 10 years or whatever. So I can understand, like, give him some time to kind of hit a stride. Same thing happened to Mark Wolfman on Nightwing. But the kid angle, still not really on board with. I'm not a fantastic proponent of that issue. But also the stupid alien invasion, like, that was just lame. It just wasn't good. Now, the second half of this book was good. And that was where the JLA shows up at Wally's home. And they're like, your kids are all over the news. What, you know, they're like 10 years old. What are you doing? Like, what, you know, trying to like talk some sense into them, and trying to appeal to Wally and Linda about the safety of their children. Mm-hmm. And of course, Wally at first takes it like, you're taking my kids away from me. No way in hell am I going to let that happen. But also, they had a really nice moment that I thought where Roy kind of steps up. Is like, you know, we were Teen Titans together. But that was a different time. Like, things weren't as bad as they are now. This is, you know, it's not the same type of world anymore. And then Batman steps up and he's like, you know, he's right. It's not the same world. This, you know, no matter how smart or clever your kids are, this is no business for them. And then Wally just snaps, you? I'm seeing this from you, the man who's gone through four Robins? And I was like, when I read that, I was like, oh, snap.
Yeah, he hit him as hard as he possibly could. Yeah. And, you know, that was a very good point, because you find out that, and it was really kind of emotional, because you find out that, like, you know, the kids have aged so quickly, and that basically Wally and Linda don't know if they're going to wake up tomorrow, and if their kids are going to be 30, and if they wake up in 2 weeks, if their kids are going to be dead. So, like, they're just doing everything they can with these kids while they can, and that's a pretty ballsy move to take with these kids.
Yeah, I liked that, and I like that development, and I think that's going to be an open door for a retcon in the future. Like, not right away, but well later on. But I thought it was kind of a nice little moment, and also on the plus side, Freddie Williams II did the art for this book, and I talked about how good he is on that. Yeah, how good he is on Robin, and he brought that over to this book, and I love his art. It's very animated, but especially for a book like this, I was saying before how Acuna's art didn't really fit the style of this book, because you almost need a more animated look to The Flash. That this is perfect. Like, I hope he stays on
this book. This was great. I hope he stays on this book for a while.
Yeah, so, quid pro quo.
Last book I wanted to talk about was Daredevil number 101. You know, Matt Murdock is kind of he's kind of Marvel's Bruce Wayne. And we talked about how Matt Murdock and Bruce Wayne, they always kind of, like, ride this line in between, like, losing it and keeping in control. And Matt Murdock is really, really tipping over that line right now. And, like, you feel it in this book. Basically, what's going on is that we've had this villain named Mr. Fear, and it's so complicated about what's going on. But the underlying story is that Matt's wife, Mila, her mind was infected, basically, and she would just get these random bouts of anger because she was near this woman, and she ended up killing a person because of it, throwing someone in front of a train. It was totally by accident, but it happened. So now she's under trial for murder, and she's in mental ward, and Matt can't see her, and there's a villain behind all of this. And so what we're seeing in this story is we're seeing Matt going, you know, to bars, going to hideouts, and just beating the crap out of, you know, these thugs and these, you know, street toughs or whatever, just to get information. And he's not like Michael Lark does art in this book, and looking at these pages hurts. Like, you're seeing broken bones, and it's really like it just has that feeling that this is like Matt Murdock, you know, gloves off. Which, obviously, if you're gonna have like a Daredevil Batman book, it always has to run that line. It's always like he has to go a little bit far and he has to come back. And so you're getting these things like him having to go and break into Mila's hospital ward just to spend the night with her and see her and try to hold her. And you have so much feeling for this character. Like, Brubaker's doing such a good job. It's just like, you're like, you know, what does it take for one man to truly just break? And that's what you're seeing with Matt Murdock right now.
This one's interesting.
Yeah, it's a great book. I can't say enough about Daredevil. Ever since Bendis took it over and Brubaker has just taken that and just gone with it, it's amazing.
Okay. Well, that really kind of covers what I actually wanted to talk about this week. So, our next feature, we wanted to talk about special Halloween theme. We wanted to talk about the Monster Squad.
The Monster Squad!
This is a movie that David and I both treasure very, very dearly. And we realized that the 20th anniversary DVD just came out recently. So we've been huddled around our DVD players watching that. And for those who aren't aware of the Monster Squad, it was a movie that came out in 1987. And it was a story, kind of a Goonies-esque story, about a group of young kids ranging from, like, I don't know, 5 to 15 years old. Right. And they get in this adventure where they fight, like, the old classic Universal monsters, like Dracula and Frankenstein and the Wolfman. The creature from the Black Lagoon, and it's hilarious. It's part kind of pseudo horror and part comedy, very in the vein of Goonies. But and it also has that very 80s feel to it, like, you know, any, I don't know, like Karate Kid or anything like that. Like, just that.
Well, I think this has, you know, it's funny going back, because sometimes you go back to, you see 80s movies. It's weird to go back and see that there's a lot of things that they got away with in this movie with kids that you could not get away with kids in movies nowadays.
No, it's true. It's so true.
You had kids throwing around homophobic slurs every now and then. They're calling one of the characters in the movie Scary German Guy. Times have changed, Eric. Times have changed.
One of the best characters in the movie is, you know, usually these kid movies do usually tend to have one overweight kid, but in today's kind of PC world, they don't draw too much. They might make a joke here and there, but they don't draw too much attention to it. Throughout the entire movie, this kid's name is, or they call this kid Fat Kid. That's all they ever call him.
The whole movie.
And one of the best parts of the movie is where he finally reveals his name. And, anyone... Please go back and watch this movie by Fred Decker. It's kind of like
a cult movie. I mean, it really is a good movie. Like Eric said, like it's a mix of comedy and horror, because there are elements of the movie that are they're not genuinely scary. I mean, but for that time, they would have been. Like, if you were watching that in 1987, the special effects were actually pretty good. And so, like, the stuff with, like, even the Wolfman, looking back on it now, the special effects that they had with the Wolfman were actually pretty good.
Yeah, I was impressed. I was actually surprised by how decent they were. And we're talking in the time before computer-generated everything. Yep. So actually, it kind of does it a credit. Like, I thought the Wolfman transformation was done way better in that movie than a lot of the, you know,
yeah, the CG.
CGI stuff that you see nowadays.
Yeah, so yeah, definitely check it out. It's definitely kind of like, you know, the sleeper kind of cult film. It's the Monster Squad. And if you are listening to the podcast, then I can pretty much guarantee that you will love the movie.
Yes. And the best, you guys will all figure it out, but when you watch it, best line in the movie, Wolfman has nards.
Wolfman does have nards.
Just remember that. And that line alone should make you want to go out and see this movie. So, check it out. And so, on to our top five, we had a question this week, didn't we, David?
Well, yeah, more a request. Tim, who is one of our listeners from Miami, we talked about him a little bit last week. He wanted to know, he had a pretty vague request, and we're kind of putting our own little spin on it, but he wanted to know what we thought were the top five costume design in superhero comics. And so, I'm going to do that with a little bit of spin, because I'm going to do top five costume changes. And Eric, I think you're going to take a couple things from maybe TV or from movies.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of stick with what you're doing. I'm looking at, like, costume transitions, I guess, you know, when they've updated things. But I'm not going to necessarily stick to comics. I'm going to look at television and movies and stuff like that, too. I'll start off. My first one is actually the X-Men. Because the X-Men from comics to movie.
Okay.
And this was something that... Yeah, when they were filming the X-Men movie, I'm like, well, how are they going to do the costume? Because Wolverine's a badass, yeah, we all know, but, like, right. You put that mask on, and even in the comics, it looks ridiculous with some art. Not so much anymore, they've kind of toned it down a lot, but I remember back in the 80s, like, when those black sides of his mask, like, when they would come off, like, 2 feet off of his mask
exactly.
On each side.
Yeah.
And I was like, God, you know, guys, that kind of looks ridiculous. And then I was like, what again? Make him like what kind of mask are they going to do in the movie? And instead, they took a different route and they had him all these really kind of svelte leather getup and I kind of thought maybe they'd do like the original Batman movie where they just kind of put them all in molded rubber costumes and have them do like really kind of dark looking either X-Men First Class or X-Men Jim Lee era type costumes, only kind of molded rubber. But no, the leather costumes worked really cool. There were no masks or anything like that, which I thought was a good point. You know, these are just people from a school. They're freedom fighters. They're not going to necessarily wear masks.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really a very cool design. Like, they all matched, but yet they all kind of had a bit of individuality to them. So, yeah, well done to Bryan Singer's crew, because I thought they did a really good job translating that and making it, like, they even made a joke, like, what were you expecting, blue and yellow spandex? And it's just, like, you realize that doesn't work in the real world.
Yeah, no, definitely. No, it's a good choice.
I like it, so.
My number five is the Iron Spider costume from Civil War.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm picking that is because... It was very short-lived, exactly as it should have been, and it's not so much about the costume, but what the costume represented. I was a big, big fan of Peter being under Tony Stark's, you know, wing, and Peter finally, you know, getting to the point where he wasn't sure, you know, who was right and who was wrong, and then finally him making the decision that, okay, like, Tony's wrong. You had the fight between them in the suit, and then you had a fight between them out of the suit. And so I think that outfit, like, it was the story, you know? It was like a tool to move the story along.
That's
and
true.
I think it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
Like, it shouldn't have been there for a long time, and it wasn't. And so it's one of those things where you look back on it, I'm like, yeah, the Iron Spider costume, I thought that was cool, because I think about the story. It was great, and that's it. That's exactly, like, what, you know, because you're going to go through changes, and that's okay, but you're always going to go back to the iconic, you know, uniform. And so, when you're going to go through those changes, it's exactly like how it should be. Something short-lived and something that should directly correlate to the story.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Very good point. Next one I'm going to go to is Nightwing. Because, boy, oh boy, if there was
Are we talking about the collar?
We're talking about the transition away from the collar.
Oh, I love the collar.
Because, man, if there was ever a guy who's been, you know, who's had some unfortunate costumes, it's Dick Grayson. And, okay, I love his Robin costume just because it is so ridiculous and is a product of the 1940s and, you know, he was a circus acrobat, so it kind of makes sense. But, and granted, when he became Nightwing in the 80s, it was the 80s, but he had this enormous like, high boy Elvis collar that came up, and then it was cut down, like, way in his chest, too, so yeah, it was just like...
That was a bad costume, and man.
Depending on what artist you had, that got, like, way above his head at some points, too. So it was just ridiculous. And then we got something a little bit better, like, they got rid of the collar, and it was a little bit darker, but it still... Yeah, and then finally we got the black costume, which finally he looks badass. It's like, it's a long time coming. Very, very, and he cut his hair, finally. Because the night mullet was awesome, but it, you know, gotta grow up sometimes.
Yeah, there's a certain time period for the night mullet.
Yeah, so.
My number four is the ultimate version of Captain America.
Ooh, nice.
There's not much I could say, but, like, I think that there's a very fine line between how Captain America in the current Marvel Universe looks iconic and looks ridiculous, especially with the little wings on his helmet. And it's not even a helmet, it's just like a mask. And what they did is that they basically took the ultimate Captain America and they basically showed that his costume in the Ultimate Universe is based off his costume in World War II. Like, he wears an actual helmet with a little buckle. And when you first see it, you're like, it looks a little bit ridiculous, but it looks like something that Steve Rogers would be, like, comfortable fighting in.
Well, it looks like a soldier outfit, too. Like, they got rid of the pirate boots are gone, and he has soldier boots on. And,
right, you know, he has, like, the mask, you know, the...
strap on it. And...
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So, it's just very simple, and it just basically looks like, yeah, exactly, you're completely right. It looks like a soldier's uniform. And I think it was perfect for Captain America. So, number four.
Number three was Superman's black outfit.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, I love it. Now, we just got done talking about when a bullet needed to go. This is when a bullet was welcome. This was early 1990s, and it worked. This was another costume that served to push the story, although not as much. It was just like, we're going to put him in this, and we'll figure out why later.
Right.
But it was just cool. It was just a very simple design, and Superman rarely ever changes costumes in, like, 70 years of publishing. He's had very little change to his costume, and it's pretty standard.
What about the electric Superman?
I'm not gonna. I forget.
Oh, that. Yeah,
it's the. I'm not. Hey, we can do a top five worst costume things too. So this, all right, we're sticking to good here. But no, I mean, it was just simple. It was elegant. It was very sleek. I don't know. Sometimes just simplicity is better in my eyes, and that's the same thing with the Nightwing costume. Right. And if you just go with a more simpler design, it was the same thing. You know it's not going to last forever. But it was cool while it was there. So, and it kind of, to see that, it reminds me of a very fond time I have for comics, even though a lot of people blame that event for kind of what happened to comics later that decade. Yeah. But I really enjoy that era, especially that storyline. And I was like, you know, that kind of takes me back to a time and a place. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. My number three, which I think this is probably going to be on your list, is Kyle Rayner's first Green Lantern uniform.
Yes. This was badass.
Yeah, the reason why, and this is, it's basically, it's just what you said. This, it takes me back to a time and a place, and, yeah, like, you know, the 90s were the 90s. You know, everything was extreme, and everything was big, and everything was, had to be better, and I was a child of the 90s, you know, and Hal Jordan's uniform was just lame. Like, it was just boring, and I look at it now, and I don't think that, you know? I have a different state of mind. But back then, as a kid, it was boring. And so you saw Kyle Rayner come along, and he had that costume, was like, oh, okay, it's something new, whatever. And then he makes his own costume, and it was awesome. Like, it was just awesome. I remember, I can still see it, the page where he's with Alex, and she's talking to him about how he's an artist, and so why can't he just design his own costume? And then it cuts to that splash page of him and Eric. You take it from there.
It was good. One thing, and to go back to this time period again, it's like the Green Lanterns. You know, Alan Scott had his original costume, but from the 60s to the 90s, Hal Jordan's costume hadn't changed a whole lot either. And by the 90s, even by the late 80s, early 90s, for a kid reading comics. And I know there's a lot of people that will disagree with me on this, but as a kid reading Green Lantern back then, I found it very hard to relate to Hal Jordan as a likable character. Like, yeah, he was kind of stoic, and he was kind of a conservative character. And, you know, he had these white streaks in his hair. He was kind of old-looking. Yeah, sure. You know, he looked like my dad. And so it was just like, it wasn't really relatable. And then you put this young guy, Kyle, in the costume, and it was like, okay, well, that's kind of cool. And then he creates his own costume, which was so different from anything that you'd ever seen before. And like, there was no gloves, he just kind of had these gauntlets, and the mask was completely different. It had these kind of,
and the symbol was different. That was huge.
Yeah, they redid the symbol, and like, that's huge when they redo a symbol. So I mean, it was so different, and it was just very cool. And you look back now and you're just like, yeah, that's pretty 90s looking. But I mean, they even brought some of those elements. Like, they brought the mask back for his newest costume, which I was happy about. But, I mean, it was cool. And, like I said, it's just so different from what you'd seen for the previous 30 years.
Right.
So, and in a good way. I'm not talking about, like, Ezreal Batman armor kind of way, where you're just like, ooh, you know.
That's one for the top five worst.
Yeah, no, this was, I knew you were going to talk about it, so I replaced it on my list, but it was really good. So we're up to number two, I believe. And my number two is Oliver Queen Smallville costume.
Oh, okay. All right. That is good.
This is another one. And I was just watching the episode Justice, and all of them, all the characters that they brought into that all had kind of the standard, like a vest and a hood and glasses and stuff like that. That all worked with their costume and themes, but Oliver Queen's was really cool. Like, he had the bow that folded up into a side holster instead of carrying it on his back. He didn't have the little Robin Hood hat. He had the hood from the Longbow Hunters miniseries, which looked really cool. And instead of like a domino mask, he had like these super Oakley sunglasses, and it just looked badass. Like, this is again, and The main costume was kind of, it was a leather costume, but it wasn't leather like the original Batman costume is, where it's cumbersome to move in and stuff like that. It was just more like a vest.
Yeah, it was very sleek, easy to move in.
Yeah, and it
No, that's a great choice, because yeah, that was a very, very slick costume.
Yeah, it looks feasible in a real world environment. Like, okay, if the superheroes did exist, that's more like something that they'd run around in instead of tights.
Yeah, no, so that's a great choice.
Yeah.
My number two is Peter Parker's black costume.
That had to be, wow, I thought that'd be your number one, actually.
Yeah, I think it might surprise you with my number one. But, you know, talk about the costume dictating the story. I mean, the symbiote, the costume, it was the story all along. And half the time, you didn't even know that it was a story. Because, you know, it came after the Secret War, and he had this costume, and all of a sudden he started to change, and he started to get a little bit more aggressive. And then you find out that the costume's an alien. And there's just so much with it. Obviously, we all know the whole story. And I'm not even considering the symbiote becoming Venom afterwards. because while I love the Venom character, I honestly liked just the symbiote as a villain more. Like, because you almost felt bad for the symbiote because it just, like, it needed Peter. Like, it just, on this primary, just primal level, like, it needed Peter. Like, it needed to bond with him, and I guess, I mean, in that way, there's no kind of greater villain than someone like that. Like, just, that just had that need.
Plus, it's always nice to have that villain who you don't fight with your fists, you have to fight with your heart, exactly, and your soul and your brain and stuff like that. And that was, you know, that's the symbiote. Is it affected his mind, it affected how he behaved to his loved ones and stuff like that. And that is the sign of a great villain. But also, much like I said with the Superman thing, it took a very kind of a very recognized costume that people had seen for, you know, 20, 30 years at that point, and
yeah,
just made it very, very simple and very, very sleek. I mean, it looked deadly.
Yes, it looks like it's completely different than his. I mean, talk about doing a total 180. And I do believe, like, the first thing I think about when I think about Superman's black costume is that I do think that it was a total ripoff of Peter's black costume, which is okay. It's extremely simple, like so simple to the point like where you almost wouldn't think that it would work because it's all black. There's a spider in the middle, the eyes are white, and then he has the knuckles that are white. But it just looks so badass. And yeah, like Eric knows, like I have some prized possessions, but I have a black Spider-Man statue, which I treasure probably above all else. And
it's
I love
true. It's pretty sweet. So, yeah, that's definitely good. And there's reasons why people love that costume. I mean, it's a fan favorite. So, okay, big moment, number one pick. This is probably not going to come to any surprise, but it's going to be Tim Drake's, his first costume that was designed for him by Neil Adams. And that was finally when Robin graduated from having the short pants and the very bright colors. He still had bright colors, but they added, you know, long pants. He got boots instead of booties. Right. And, you know, the back of the cape became black, and he just had a much more edgier look at this point. And this was another kind of thing of the 90s, but it definitely was time to update that costume. And, and like I said, I love the original costume just because it's a symbol. You know, just as any superhero costume is, and it's like, that's, you know, it was made into an icon, but it needed updating. And who better to update a costume than a classic artist like Neil Adams? And so he came in and he redesigned it. He added kind of an armor chest plate and stuff like that. So it made it semi-functional that, yeah, if you're going to have a teenager out fighting crime, you're going to want to give him some protection. Right. And so they stuck him in this thing, and The original artists that worked on drawing him were Tom Lyle and Norm Breyfogle. And to this day, those are my absolute favorite Robin artists. Like, that's the kind of, those are the comics I remember reading as a kid, and just like, wow, that's badass artwork. And it just looked so dynamic and so cool. And it was just a great design. Like, it was kind of a multicolored ninja outfit.
Exactly. That's exactly what it looks like.
And and he's got a new costume now, which I don't, like, it's okay, and I understand, like, it was time to update it, but the reason he was given the first costume, in a story perspective, was he'd finally earned the right, after a year of training in the comics, they were finally going to let him put on the suit, and it was such a big deal. And he's standing there, and he's looking at the display case with the old costume in it, and you know, Bruce is asking him if he's afraid to put it on. He's like, no, you know, it's just like, he says, you know, Dick made it into a symbol the whole world knows, and Jason gave his life for it. And he's like, failing them and what they fought so hard to build, that's what I'm afraid of. And Bruce is like, well, you know, I'd be failing you if I expected you to bear that weight. So he gave him a box, and he came out, and he had the new costume on. I was like, that's good stuff. So it's just always going to hold a very special place in my heart. Like, that's Tim Drake right there. So that's my number one.
All right. You have no idea what my number one's going to be, huh? I kind of threw you off with the Black Spider-Man.
You did. I was like, I'm excited.
Yeah, and I think you'll agree. My number one, you saw it at the very end of an issue, the last page, and it will always stay in my mind as one of the, like, I think I probably jumped up and cheered when I saw this. And my number one pick is Bart Allen as Kid Flash.
Oh, yes. That was a good one.
You know, Geoff Johns' first Titans arc was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. And he had been using Bart and showing weird things with Bart, like how Bart, when Bart read something at super speed, he would remember it. And it was the first time that a writer had treated Bart with some respect. Like, that Bart just isn't this kid who just goofs around. But, like, there was so much more to Bart than meets the eye. And the worst thing happens, you know? Like, he gets shot, and he gets hurt, and he's in the hospital. And all of a sudden, like, there's this scene where the Titans are worried about Bart, and they're trying to find him. And they go to a library, and Bart's there. And he's just reading every single book in the library. And he's not even acknowledging that the Titans are there. And they can't even see him because he's moving so fast. And at the very end, he breaks out in the Kid Flash. And it's that moment where, like, Bart Allen matured. Like, that the Bart Allen that I think about and I know is not the Bart Allen that, you know, that, like, it really was Kid Flash. It wasn't Impulse. Like, I don't look at Bart Allen. I look at Bart Allen as the Flash. I look at Bart Allen as Kid Flash. But I do not see Bart Allen as Impulse anymore. And it was that moment.
Yeah, I think Lawton is credited to the art of that run. But
Mike McCone had amazing art.
Yeah, and the fact that it was a very visual progression. And your character, you understand why he was coming to this point. And it was definitely a graduation moment for him. And it was a very triumphant feeling, and it felt good.
And it was finally like him taking on the mantle of the Flash, like him finally embracing that.
Yeah, and he kind of fought a little bit before, but, you know, and they even brought it up that, you know, they had a conversation between Bart and Tim, and Tim's like, are you sure you want to do this? You know, you're going to be living in the Flash's shadow. And Bart's like, no, he'll be living in mine. And it's like, oh, wow, that's good stuff.
Yeah, it was, I just remember that last page and that whole story arc, and I was just so happy because, like, I always thought that Bart was just, like, this amazing character that, like, was so underused, and that Geoff Johns was, like, bringing out, like, all the potential that he had, and then they went and killed him. But
you had a good, like, year with him.
But I still have my good memories, and, him becoming Kid Flash is, like, one of, like, my favorite comic book moments ever.
Yeah, it's a good one. All right, well, thanks, Tim, for that top five suggestion. That was great. If any listeners out there have their own top five they want to see us do, you can always contact us at contact@fanboystrikeback.com. Send us emails, what you like, don't like about the show, what you'd like to see on the show. You can also go to our website at www.fanboysstrikeback.com. And there we post our comic reviews for the week. We post videos that we think you might like. We comic news that is breaking, you know, here and there with the movies and stuff like that. So also there's a link to our forums page on there, and there we have topics set up that we like to go on and talk about and like to see on there, and we like to respond to what you guys say. And if you want to go on and start a topic, please start it. And if you're wondering what we think about something, that's the great place to talk about it. So we also have the MySpace, don't we?
Yes, you can go to myspace.com/thefanboystrikeback. We do our blog there, our book of the week. We always do that on our website and our MySpace page. And you can come there and befriend us and do the whole MySpace thing. And then also you can catch this podcast on iTunes, Podcast Alley, and pretty much any podcatcher out there. If you do like us, please leave us a review. Positive reviews do a lot to help us out, get the word of mouth out there, and get new listeners. And we definitely appreciate you guys leaving us any kind of feedback, because any feedback helps us out. So I think that's it for this week. I'm David.
I'm Eric.
And we'll see you guys next week.
Never let you forget.